Is an answer to the Lord's call possible under these conditions, and if so, in what must it consist? In the course of the past centuries, the entrance into the religious life supposed a retreat from the world and temporal tasks. But in our day, and this is no small revolution, the Church, by means of the newly formed secular institutes, places the religious life at the doorstep of those who cannot leave the world. Like all the religious orders, these institutes have as an end the perfection of their members in the love of God and neighbor. Thus the religious life is not incompatible with the widow's life, encumbered as it is with familial and professional tasks. Already many have been called by God to the perfection of charity and have joined these new religious institutes without shirking their secular responsibilities. That they find the basic characteristics of all religious life: fraternal support, a formation, direction, a supple rule of life adapted to their state, and finally the promises or vows by which they consecrate their life to God. Without doubt it will take time for this new form of the religious life to take definitive form, just as the classical religious orders did not attain their present forms at the very outset. We are in a tentative period of trials and passionate inquiry. How can the widow practice poverty when she cannot abandon her property which represents the welfare of her children? How can she practice obedience without arriving at the inadmissible and distasteful solution of having a superior be the true head of her family? The whole problem consists in finding a new form of the religious life adapted to the widow's situation, without being at the same time a depreciated religious life. If widowhood presents difficulties in the pursuit of a perfect life, a lack of time, of opportunities for peaceful contemplation, overwork, isolation, it can also facilitate the ascent of the soul by the solitude that it exacts, by the sacrifice and servitude it brings in its wake. It requires much love. It is the daily renewed offering of the husband God recalled, the renouncement of future maternities, the sad surprise of not finding the same consideration as before around the house. It is solitude, a ravenous monopolization of family life, being torn between the needs of love and authority with the children, between the spiritual responsibilities of the formation of souls and the most temporal tasks. A true religious formation must teach the widow the art of using every occasion to forget herself in order to grow in the love of God. Often the widow has the impression of being absorbed in daily tasks. She envies the nuns the silence of the cloister occupying themselves with God alone. She must remember that what counts in the end is not silence, or long prayer or even monastic peace, but doing the will of God. I don't say to do it with great love, because it is often quite difficult to know if one loves, but with a humble goodwill renewed each day. The years will pass and perhaps the dominating impression will be that she has not advanced at all, until the day when she need wait no longer, and the widow, astonished even as was Anne the prophetess, meets her Saviour. Widows who have found Christ follow him step by step. They possess his joy. The glory of the Father is their raison d'etre. They have understood that all is grace. Having accepted the loss of everything for the love of Christ, they find everything again in the love of Christ, and first of all, their life's companion who from henceforth will be their companion for eternity. Several ways of religious life welcome widows. Some receive celibates and widows. Others are reserved to widows. Among the latter, some put the accent on contemplation, others on apostolic and charitable action, some on detachment from the past, others on the permanence of a spiritual bond which binds the widow to the partner who has preceded her before God. There are those which are associated with the large religious family, others orient their offering to the church, the priests, the families. How meaningful the sacrifice of the widows must be to those who are making a real effort to live a truly evangelical family life. There are already many mansions in the house of the Father. Perhaps the time is not far off when the women whom God called to dedicate their widowhood will receive a particular consecration. It would restore to them the place of honor and service in the church which was theirs in the first centuries of the Christian era. It would seem to be in the line of tradition. If the church has always solemnly affirmed her praise for the grandeurs of Christian marriage, will she not praise still more virginity and consecrated widowhood? For virginity and consecrated widowhood distinctly proclaim the judgeship of God, and that union of love with Him is the true end of human life. Family groups. Signs of grace. For the historian of family groups, 1949 will be a conspicuous year. It was then that they suddenly came forth out of the shadows. People took an interest in them, they began to speak of them. The attention of the general public was aroused. The year is not actually the birth date of family groups, but it marks their public appearance. For more than 10 years before, they had an intense and quiet existence, a little like the young Christian communities in Imperial Rome. In this phase of its slow maturation, I could not find more than 2 articles concerning these groups of families in the Catholic press. In one of these, in 1944, Father de Lestapis dedicated an enthusiastic and, I would say, prophetic article to them under the evocative title, Toward a New Christianity Through Family Groups. He predicted what today's efforts would mean, God willing, in 50 years. But it is especially in the last 3 years that we have witnessed mushrooming of family groups in France and the Union Française, in Belgium, Switzerland, Austria, Egypt, Canada, and doubtlessly in other places. Since this article was 129. First published in 1949, such family groups have developed in many countries. If these family groups were the invention of a man, or if their development was due to publicity or arbitrary initiatives, we could dispense with them. But they began spontaneously and without preconceived ideas, Father Rouquet. Considering the amplitude of the phenomenon, the rapidity of its expansion, and the numerous marks of Christianity, we must conclude that it is a manifestation of an interior compulsion, a sign of grace. Those who search out vital currents in the church follow the developments of the family groups with great interest. Where do they come from? Where are they going? Where do they belong in relation to the great movements of thought and action of our times? First of all, let us ask if there is a relationship between this germination of family groups throughout the Christian world and reflections on a family spirituality. These psychological, philosophical, and theological reflections have for some years pursued the idea of a deeper conjugal and familial spirituality. This work of theologians, philosophers, and priests concerned with the movement is part of the impulse that originated the formation of the family groups. It is one of the most important signs of the spiritual history of our times, says Father Rouquet. Have the family groups been created by this speculative effort? Or conversely, has it been provoked, encouraged, and supported by the family groups? Is there a relationship between them? I believe that it is an interaction and a reciprocal influence rather than a dependence. Without doubt, the reviews and publications on conjugal spirituality favored the birth of these family groups and the care of their interior life. And conversely, the desire of these homemakers to live an integral Christianity obligated the researchers to keep pace. These two efforts, if not dependent upon one another, have perhaps a common source. For 30 years, two educators who followed young Christians through engagement and marriage, one thing was obvious. The young people have reconciled love and marriage. They do not subscribe to the oft-repeated phrase, love is one thing, marriage another. For them, marriage and love are one and the same thing. Since they have not squandered their wealth of love during the years preceding marriage, they approach it with a young heart. It should be remarked that they marry much earlier than before. The woman the young man married was the first one he had loved. And they wed precisely because they loved each other. Certainly they were not all perfect, nor did they all come to marriage pure. But those who knew weakness did not cease to think correctly, their weakness did not, in general, falsify their conception of life. It is no small thing that this alliance of love and marriage has finally been renewed. the historian of religious feeling will be compelled to say it was one of the active forces in our century. This same Christian generation arrived at adulthood with a living faith. The young people of today are not satisfied to merely be attached to their religion by tradition and conformism. They abandon what is in their eyes only formalism in tradition and conformism, and they deepen their faith in order to adhere to it with a personal motivation. This deliberate adhesion is much more than a simple acquiescence of spirit, it is love, a gift of self to a living person, Christ. Thus they come to marriage with two loves in their hearts, human love and the love of Christ. They go to the theologians to learn how to live well with both loves, and that is the origin of the elaboration of a conjugal and familial spirituality. They group together to aid each other in fulfilling this spirituality, and this marks the origin of the family groups. Cardinal Suhard, who followed the inquiries and experiments with his extraordinary gift of attention and sympathy, wrote in his letter of May 7, 1945 to Yodor, "They expect from their clergy a solid teaching, not only casuistry and ethics, but a dogma of marriage and education, an asceticism and a mystique for their state of life." This double endeavor of which we speak, the effort of Christian thinkers in search of a conjugal and familial spirituality and the effort of families to live this spirituality, is understood perfectly only if you place yourself in the wider movement of thought and life of which Gustav Thibon has written so excellently in Sicae Deo Uni, The Descent of the Sacred into the Profane, the Eternal into the Temporal, of Spirit into Life. Thibon noted the psychological and social aspects of this phenomenon. On the psychological side, in man, spirit and flesh are reconciled. The spiritual and the vital are allied. Father Zundel explains the same idea: it is not a question of knowing what liberty the flesh can authorize, but what sanctity it can assume. It is the whole man who is restored to God. In its social aspect, a sanctity which, until the present time, seemed to call for a retreat from the world affirms more and more its rights as a citizen of the world. The temporal is not, for Christians, simply the lesser part, it must be regained, put into the great current which carries all creation toward God. Christianity today is trying to establish the reign of Christ everywhere. He must prevail, it cries, following Saint Paul. Not only in the cloisters, and not only in the churches, but in all the activities of man. Isn't this what Catholic action in its multiple forms has undertaken? It would be very naive to think that this evangelization of the temporal would take place without some hard knocks and combat. The temporal is still very much in the clutches of the prince of this world, who has no intention of relinquishing his prize. Do you think that the world of work will be led to Christ without a violent effort, that the world of capital can be easily converted to the gospel? Or the world of politics, science, or art? This reconquest of nature by grace demands that sanctity must be present everywhere in the modern world. The whole problem is, will there be lay saints? Men completely dedicated to Christ, clothed in his charity, moved by his spirit, workers, farmers, heads of industry, politicians and artists who are saints? Each century has its type of sanctity. At the birth of the church and for 300 years it was a witness of blood by the martyrs. For centuries after the persecutions the monasteries were the schools of sanctity. It is well to note that the new forms of sanctity do not supplant those which preceded them, even though they often eclipse them for a time. In the 13th century, when Christianity lived comfortably and churches and monasteries were honored and richly endowed, sanctity took on a role of poverty with the mendicant orders. During the Renaissance, sanctity manifested itself in the great mission spirit which carried the religious to the New World and to the four corners of the earth. Following this effort, congregations founded to educate the young and to help all those in physical and moral distress multiplied. In the 19th century, women departed for the foreign mission fields. May we not think that the 20th century opens an era of sanctity for the married laity? It is not easy to be a saint in the midst of the world. For some years now, more and more Christians have accepted the responsibility of being present everywhere in the city.